Hello. And our guest experiencing the tingle factor today fits a variety of descriptions. Author, poet, philosopher, conservationist, and advisor to princes. He's a jazz musician with a military career which is probably better known to today's generation than either that of Napoleon or Attila the Hun. But he's most firmly fixed in our minds by the one simple four-letter word, goon. Spike Milligan, how would you give me a dictionary definition of the word goon?
Well, there isn't one. It was used by Max Fleischer cartoons before the war. These creatures which inhabited Popeye. They're sort of amorphic with no face and a Torx bubble with, like, wallpaper in it. Mm-hmm. And, it seems so amusing to me. And then it was used for the German guards during the war, the goons. And they did call American thugs goons. That's it. So it's an amorphic word, you know.
And is Spike the name your parents gave to you?
No, the army gave me that. Like in the army, if you're white, you're called Chalky, or Murphy, you're called Spud. And if you're Milligan, you're called Spike.
Long before your radio and television career, which goes back over some 40 years now, you started out as a band musician, didn't you?
Well, we were so poor that we didn't have any money, and I had this yearning to be a musician. First of all, I used to win Bing Crosby contests, and then you couldn't just sit in a band, so you had to learn, so I learned to play the guitar. Mm-hmm. Then it wasn't loud enough, the age before the electric guitar, so I then learned to play the trumpet, and I played it very well. In fact, I had an audition just for the war with Oscar Raban's band at Hammersmith Palais, second trumpet. And then I got called up, and I've come down since.
Was it from those years that we get your first tingle?
Well, there's a tingle. I get a tingle of lots of records. But one in particular was called the Woody Herman Herd, the band that plays the blues. And they recorded a piece called The Four Brothers. And what made it unique was the first time that four tenor saxophones had been scored as a harmonic quartet. Normally it's alto, two tenors, and baritone. Here's his four tenor sax players. It was the most superbly balanced reed team the world's ever known. The tune was wonderfully middle of the road. I said middle of the road. You think you cover entire marks, don't you? And it was a superb piece of music, a great piece of jazz music.
Woody Herman and Four Brothers. Spike, is your love of music because of your parents or in spite of your parents?
Well, my father was a singer and a dancer, apart from being a soldier. My mother was a musician and a trained contralto. She used to sing with the governor's band in India before Lord Willingdon. It runs in the family. My brother was a tenor saxophonist. My auntie was a trained soprano. Yes, music all the way down the line, yes.
What sort of songs did your mother sing with the band?
Oh, drink deep of the waters, Melusine, at the sunrise now, go on the horn, horn, little that stuff, you know what I mean.
That stuff. Spike, how do you listen to music? Do you play it a lot and sit down and concentrate, or do you just have it on as an accompaniment to whatever you happen to be doing during the day?
Oh, I couldn't be a barbarian like that that most people in England are today, you know. I have my room double glazed, so I don't get any noise, and I listen to it, and it's one of the great pleasures of my life.
So you don't have a radio in the car or things like that to listen to music?
Well, I listen to the test match or rugby like this, but the quality of sound is so bad on a car radio. It's like listening to it in Braille almost. You know?
Did your involvement with what people call classical music begin when you were little, or did that come later?
My grandmother and grandfather used to sing classical pieces more like my Brave Arab Steed and the Larboard Watch. And then during the war, somebody gave me two tickets to go to the San Carlo Opera House where Puccini's Bohème was being played. And of all things, Gigli was playing the part of Rudolph. And I was stunned. This music was gorgeous, totally treacly and over the top, but nevertheless gorgeous. And I've never stopped listening to classical music since. You know.
Well, you not only share my love for Puccini and Boheme, but you also share my love for Ravel. It's an odd thing about Ravel. Have you noticed, you're talking about being in a jazz band, how many jazz musicians seem to admire Ravel's writing?
Well, yes. I don't know it, but it has all the, what's that word, that sort of jazz feeling without any tempo to it. That's the measure of him as a jazz man, yes.
And what are you going to play for us today from Ravel?
Well, I was going around the shop once looking, and I saw this thing, and I didn't decide, I thought it's Ravel, that's good enough for me, and I took it home, and there was this delicious, beautiful, delicately balanced piece. Sheer delight from beginning to end, and also his ability to structure small ensembles like this. It's, they have to use the word genius, that's all. But in it I discovered there was a delightful little waltz that suddenly came out in the middle sections like this.
Ravel's Introduction and Allegro, that was Skylar Kanga with the Nash Ensemble. What wonderful textures in that music.
Mm.
When you were making your choice of recordings for us to play, how important were the performances? I mean, are there some pieces which you wouldn't have included were it not for a particular interpretation?
Well, I have heard various pianists, well, so we say, like, say, Chopin as an example of pyrotechnics and music, but also emotionally structured. So I think you have to be in tune. And I've heard so different many tempi played with Chopin. I don't know if I'm such a savant to say, but sometimes it's dead down the middle and you think, this guy is right. This is right. And I've got agitated if the tempi is faster or slower. I've actually thought, oh, no, funny like this, you know. There seems a moment of truth in the music, and the pianist has to discover it. Yeah.
And that is so, I suspect, of your next choice, which is Errol Garner.
Long way from Chopin. It's the wrong colour for a start. Anyhow, but he invented such a superb new jazz piano style, the like of which I don't think has been before or since. And in this particular number, he obscures the introduction so cleverly. And he surprises the audience to such an extent they actually applaud the introduction. Don't often get that. It's I Remember April. Thank you.
Errol Garner.
People who might be interested in the pianistic styles, I'd like to explain that a wonderful rolling left hand. What he does is he picks out a chord, say it's D13th, and he puts the 13th in the bass and reverses the bass note D into the top, sort of making it a ninth. And then he rolls it from the left hand right the way through to the middle finger up to the thumb and rolls it with such degree of certainty, it's almost phenomenal.
It's a totally unique sound, that, isn't it? No other pianist could make it.
No, he's unique.
Now, your next tingle is obviously not an entirely serious one, and I have to ask you how you came to first know and love the operatic performance which we're going to hear next.
It's Peter Sellers, who's no longer with us. In fact, he's no longer with anybody. And he played this record to me, and I was delighted that somebody could make such an appalling sound and be recorded and go to
Carnegie Hall,
fill it out completely, two nights running, and not one member of the audience gave the game away. It was super. I have a perversity. I mean, say, I watch Dynasty in Dallas and I roar with laughter the whole way through. I pour with laughter at EastEnders. Coronation Street didn't give me that much of a buzz, but when I hear something really awful, like I actually go out of my way to look up bad black and white films. I saw East of Piccadilly. I got East of Piccadilly. It takes you out to Lewisham, doesn't it? You know, this awful black and white film and people talking like this. Now listen here. And that's it. I'm an iconoclast. A musical and classic iconoclast. I love hearing people destroy themselves, as only this woman can do.
Florence Foster Jenkins with Cosme McMoon at the piano singing a Mozart aria from The Magic Flute.
She never... It had to be the word magic, honestly. Couldn't have been a worse piece.
Well, as we said, you started out as a professional musician playing in a band. Why did you give it up? Did you deliberately choose not to do it anymore?
Well, no, the war came along and I formed a little four-piece jazz band. After the war was over in North Africa, we wanted to form a concert party. And we did, and I played the jazz band, but I used to say to them, we just can't go and play jazz. We've got to tell a few jokes in between. So I tell a few jokes in between, and then I went into action, and I got wounded. And I was in a bad way, really. And I don't know what happened to my trumpet. It was somewhere in my kit bag somewhere. Went back, and they sent me to the Central Pool of Artists, where wounded soldiers who could do an act would be kept. And I used to play the guitar, and one day I had a superb hot violin player called Bill Hall and a bass player called Johnny Mulgrew, who used to play with Ambrose before the war. We formed a trio, which was very much like the Hot Club de France. We did marvellously well. The troops, we came over here and we died a death, and then I just dropped it, you know, that's all. It's a strange, perverse course, but strange to end up not playing it at all.
Was it one of the happiest times of your life?
The greatest, yeah.
You ever been tempted to try and go back to it?
Well, I've been practicing my trumpet cornet in the last month, trying to get my lip back in. It's very difficult, but then I'm trying. Even on this program, I must say I'm trying.
Your next choice, obviously, brings it to your guitar days, Wes Montgomery, and Here's That Rainy Day. How did you fall in love with that?
Well, one night I went down to Ronnie Scott's old place. It was just a little room with the bottles of wine to drink. And there was this... We had £5 a time to go in. I'd never heard of Wes Montgomery. And he came on, and I suddenly realised something was happening that was most unique. Playing the guitar myself, I noticed he used his thumb at a great, incredible speed, like it was omnidirectional. Everything. He used to play on the backward, upward strokes as well. Great technical rounds like this. And, of course, he was a middle-of-the-road musician, played wonderful tunes. Among his best, I think, before he died, alas, what a pity he died, was Here Comes That Rainy Day.
Is That Rainy Day by James Burke and Jimmy Van Heusen with Wes Montgomery. Spike, your next piece of classical music brings us back to France, back to Paris, indeed to the same period as Ravel, who we heard earlier, another French impressionist, Eric Satie. Tell me about you and Eric Satie.
Well, I'm an assiduous reader of biographies, and one a composite biography of the various French composers of the day. He stood apart from all the others in that he was an eccentric, total eccentric. And I like one of the things, he didn't like eating spaghetti long. And he used to chop it up into little tiny pieces and eat it with a spoon. I know that's not very important, but it is a fact. The other thing was he would give strange titles to his music, like a piano piece for Dog with a Toothache. And then just, I'd say fortuitously, I was going up to the HMV shop in Oxford Street, and there was this Le Trois Gymnopédie.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the three of them?
Three Gymnopédies, yes.
Three Gymnopédies. And then I tried to find out what the meaning of it was. But then I heard from a friend of mine, Larry Stevens, that the original idea was that it was a trapeze artist swinging back and forth. And if you listen very carefully, it's not hard to imagine. Thank you.
funny, your love of this sort of music. I mean, because underneath that understated, almost bland simplicity, it's very sad, isn't it?
Hauntingly so.
Are you a sad person inside?
Yes, I'm an Irishman, and we by decree are a depressive people, you know. We're never happy unless we're gloomy.
You're very sensitive. Does it sometimes seem to you that the world's faults outweigh its virtues?
Oh, yes, most certainly now, and I would say it would be all mainly, as you all know, on its environmental. We have a tremendous environmental problem in this world. I don't worry for myself, but I do worry for not particularly my grandchildren, but all the little children that are to follow us. We're not going to leave it in a very good state if we leave it like it is at the moment.
Well, we'll stay with this rather sentimental mood, because your next choice, something from the Edinburgh Tattoo, obviously appeals to the sentimental side of your nature, yes?
Well, Celtic, you see, the bagpipes were a musical notation of our nation, the Scots and the Irish. And when bagpipes played, I don't know why, all those clichés of the hackles and the back of your neck going up, that actually happens. But then it was reinforced during the war when I saw C Company of the 2nd Ten Irish Guards making an attack in daylight that should have been done at night across a wheat field, and the piper was with them, and I watched them all go. Very few of them get to the top. The piper was shot at them, but this incredible single piper, unarmed, I don't know, it's like, who's it said, a terrible beauty has been born. And that's how I felt about it. And of course the raison d'etre of all bagpipe playing is the 100 pipers at Edinburgh. That is immaculate. I'd rather hear them than Wagner.
The Mast Pipes from the Edinburgh Tattoo. Do you find, as you get older, that you discover less music? Does one's capacity for passion tend to contract with age?
Never. I'm still as loved music when I was about the age of 6. When I once played the ukulele in the front garden of 5 Clymer Road, Pune, while Sergeant Kidd of the Ulster Rifles knelt down and started kissing my auntie's hand. I suddenly realised I was part of this, as you say, mange of twas.
Garden seduction. I find it fascinating that as we come to the end of this programme, that almost every one of your tingles, the Sati, the Ravel, El Ghana, a lot of them amount to a small, private, almost personal statement. Have you got an aversion to sort of large forms of musical rhetoric?
Well, if you consider the combination of orchestras at the time of the early days of Mozart, and listen to the crashing, thundering noise of Beethoven's Fifth, you must admit it's got noisier. And I don't like noise.
But your final thrill is on a very grand scale indeed. It is a big orchestral work that backs his tone poem Tintagel. What were you doing when this first hit you then?
Well, I was staying in Camelford, I think it is, in Cornwall, that's right. And they've all got King Arthur's shoe shop and all that lark, you know.
Yeah.
And I saw these ruins as I was going to the shop, and they told me, this is the, they call it, in Cornwall, they call it Tintagel. Gone long Tintagel. And they told me the Arthurian legend. And then just fortuitously, in the same week I was there, I went to a gramophone record shop, and there was this Tintagel, the tone poem by Arnold Bax. I knew Arnold Bax was very interested in Celtic mysticism, greatly so, as you know. And then I heard the story that he had been convalescing in Cornwall. And one night, by moonlight, he went and sat near Tintagel. And there was an incoming tide with great breakers. And the breakers were actually disturbing at night time some of the nesting seagulls in the cliffs. And it all came to him like that.
Fascinating conclusion to a fascinating talk. Thank you very much, Spike Milligan.
Can I have the money in cash, please?